If you ask Stephen Hoff how to describe the music of Claude Debussy, he'll say, "It's a shadow. It's a trail of perfume. His music has an interesting smell to it." Well, that's an interesting way to describe the sound of Claude Debussy, and you'll hear more of what Stephen Hoff means as he talks about his new recording, the first time ever that he's delved into the music of this composer. And he'll also tell you about his very first novel. It comes out in March. It's called The Final Retreat. He refers to it as a modernist experiment. You'll find out why in this edition of New Classical Tracks. I'm Julie Amacher. Pianist Stephen Hoff, I would love to talk about your new book, which is coming out in March, I believe, The Final Retreat, your first novel.
That's right, yes, it's all done, and I think that it arrives from the publisher next week, so yeah, there's no going back now.
Well, and I have to say that what I have read about you in the past and our other conversations, the priesthood does play a role in your life, and here we have a middle-aged Catholic priest as the main character.
Right. I have to say very quickly, though, that it's not an autobiographical book. Obviously, I've drawn on thoughts that I've had about religion and the priesthood, but the character himself has nothing to do with me. I'm a basically cheerful person, and this is a suicidal man. I'm openly gay, and here's someone repressed and closeted. I don't spend my time in sleazy brothels, and this is someone who does. So there we are. There are three things that I don't have in common with my character. But what I did want to do with the book was to explore the mindset of someone in a state of desperation who's lost his faith, who's being blackmailed, who's in a terrible state and has been sent on a retreat by his bishop, just to think things through quietly for a week. And he's encouraged to keep a notebook. And in fact, this novel is his notebook, which is discovered after his death. And so that's what it is. So it's because of the very form, it's incomplete, which is also by design. I wanted not to tell a clear narrative, but to suggest things, to leave things obscure. In fact, on the very last page, which dovetails to the first page, and there's a sort of circular form, a whole new thing comes into view which you had no idea was going to happen there before, and then I leave you and the book's finished. So it's a little bit of a modernist experiment in some ways, but yeah, it comes out in March. It is available for pre-publication order now. I'm sure my publisher would be very angry if I didn't say that, but we'll see.
Well, is there anything else that's coming up for you that you're especially excited about?
Well, many different things happening. I'm writing quite a lot of music at the moment. I was very touched and delighted to be asked to write a piece for the recent winner of the Naumburg, which is the competition that I won back in 1983. And the new winner, who's a 20-year-old Albert Cano Schmidt, is the winner. And he has asked me to write his piece for his debut here in New York. So I'll be doing that over the next year, and I'm very pleased about that.
And you are in New York now, and you will be at Carnegie Hall on the 30th, right?
That's right, yes.
And your recital program includes Debussy, but you're also juxtaposing Beethoven and Schumann into that.
Yes, I did a program a few years ago at Carnegie where I put Chopin and Debussy together, and I tried to explore how they sounded similar in some ways, how they both treated the keyboard in similar fashions. This is the opposite. This, I'm contrasting Debussy with two German composers who think of the piano in a very different sort of way, and very particularly Beethoven. I don't think you could get two more dissimilar composers than Beethoven and Debussy, and I thought it would be interesting to force those two into the same program and see how the sparks fly off each of them.
Well, Stephen, this March marks the 100th anniversary of the death of Claude Debussy. And I'm wondering, why did you want to celebrate this composer with this new recording?
Well, I've loved Debussy from the very beginning when I first started to listen to classical music. I found his world of imagination, his world, the sounds that he created at the piano, magical, really. And I've never lost that kind of childlike wonder that I had when I first heard his music. And I've always enjoyed playing it, although in the last years I've been playing more of it. And then I just said to Hyperion, you know, I'd love to do a CD. And then it just so happened that the anniversary was around, which made it an even better idea. So we went into the studio and recorded, you know, all these wonderful pieces of his.
I got to thinking, whether or not perhaps you have a bit of an affinity for Debussy, because as a person, he was, of course, a composer, but also a lover of art and literature and an innovator, and I see you in all of those things as well.
Gosh, well, I wouldn't like to put myself in the same paragraph as Debussy. And actually, people tell me I haven't read too much about him. Maybe I shouldn't, that he wasn't such a nice man. So maybe I don't want to push the analogy too far. But certainly, I love his poetic sense. He supplied most of his pieces with these marvelous titles that in themselves complement the pieces that he wrote. And what I love particularly about the preludes, which I haven't recorded on this CD, that will happen, I think, in the future at some point.
But he puts the titles at the end of the pieces with the ellipses, these dots, just to suggest, well, yes, this is what the piece is about, but only just.
It's a shadow. It's a trail of perfume, if you like, behind the piece. I just find that gesture, as well as the poetic titles, so attractive and evocative.
I loved how I heard you describe his new sound as kind of like a new smell. And when you just said perfume, that reminded me of that. How do you describe his sound?
Oh, well, if you could find words for it, you wouldn't need to hear it. It's one of those instances. I think there are a lot of things involved. What happened is that just around the beginning of the 20th century, he heard the gamelan, the Javanese gamelan orchestra, at the exposition in Paris, and was, like so many people, amazed by that different sound, not just the instruments, but the tonality that these instruments had. And I think he tried to put some of that onto the piano, and in so doing, it's almost like he created a new sound for himself. It has to do with a lot of pedal, with a particular way of caressing the keys. There are moments of percussiveness in his music, but there's a lot more where you just sink into the keys as into a feather bed. And just the fastidiousness of his ear, he heard, with the piano, it's not just the note we're playing, of course. It's when we play a note on the piano, the whole of the strings vibrate in empathy with that note. And he understood this very, very clearly. And other composers, of course, knew that was happening. With Debussy, he thought, well, this is something I can actually use. It's not just a side product. I'm going to take this side product and make a new product out of it. And I think that's what you get with his music.
Now, in the first set of pieces on your new recording, Estampes, this is where we hear the influence of that gamelan you referred to. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I put this piece, Pagode, the first piece of Estampes, very much at the beginning of the piece, because this, to me, is the moment when he creates a new sound at the piano. And I find this piece, it's such a beautiful sound. It almost brings tears to my eyes, not even just because of the beauty of the music, but just that the vibrations, the sonority that he creates on the keyboard. And it's so wonderful to play. You can't help but just let go in some ways, like you on a cold day if you sit in a hot bath. Everything just sort of becomes jelly in a way. I feel there's an element of that with this piece. But I must say, straight off, this music is not just mood music, and that's really important. Debussy was a serious intellectual and a great composer in all the senses of that word. And he just didn't put down pretty sounds like many, maybe New Age music can be. This music is conceived with a great intellectual rigor, and he was very specific about his notation. Every little dot, dash, phrase, it all fits in and all makes complete sense.
Now, what's interesting about that is it helps to make the music sound almost improvised on the spot. And I'm curious, does that make it more challenging for you, the performer, or maybe more intriguing because you can make it your own?
Well, you can and you can't. That's what's interesting, really. I think what you have to do is to study the scores intensely and learn everything that's in there as far as the markings. But then when you play it, you have to play as if you're improvising. you know, he doesn't actually allow you a lot of freedom. It's interesting. He's almost too restrictive. In a piece like Children's Corner, which is later than the Estampe, if they seem like very simple pieces written, you know, for his daughter. But if you look at them, they're astonishing. They're absolutely crammed with information. There are almost more dots and markings than there are notes in those pieces. And so, yes, he wants you to feel the improvisation, but he also knows exactly how he wants it to sound.
So how do you reconcile that then as a performer?
I think you can't follow Debussy. You have to walk with him, you know, in his footsteps in that way. And that's, I think, how you overcome this. Because I think you can get over-concerned with all those markings, and they can stifle you somehow. But, you know, learn them and then, in a sense, let them go.
Now, how did you select the pieces that you chose to put on this first Debussy recording? Because, as you indicated, you're already thinking about another one.
Yeah, well, this one is, I'm focusing on the sets of pieces. So I do the three great triptych sets, Estampe and Images Books 1 and 2. And that's 9 pieces, 3 each, that are him at the height of his powers. And then I added to it the Children's Corner, which I think is a wonderful contrast. That's 6 shorter pieces. And then also there were 2 pieces that were just published individually, L'Île Joyeuse and the La Plus Collante. They're both fully mature pieces, and they both sort of go by themselves.
Now, the last two that you just mentioned, La Plus Collante and L'Île Joyeuse, are often heard in the orchestrated version. So this is kind of refreshing to hear it in the piano version. What's special about these pieces? What would you like us to hear in these works?
Well, they both create an absolutely specific atmosphere. La Plus Collante is a waltz, and it's a bit of a pun, actually. Debussy loved words, as we spoke about earlier, and this is a bit of a pun. I mean, it's been translated slower than slow or more than slow, but actually, I think what it is a take on a form of the time, the valse lente, the slow waltz. It was a something that was very popular in the cafes at the time. The, you know, the little trios or groups of musicians would play these slow, sentimental waltzes. And so this is a valse lente, and I think when he says more than slow, he's meaning this isn't just a slow waltz, this is a waltz with more to it than that. And in a way, it's a bit of a parody of a sentimental waltz. It's sweeter than sweet. It's so seductive and decadent, and it totally belongs in the Parisian cafe of that time. L'Île Joyeuse is one of the most ecstatic pieces, I think, in the piano literature. Hear a lot of Scriabin in there. It, I think the only word I think you can describe it as really is erotic. It really is smoldering with sensuality. And it means, of course, that the island of joy, and I don't really need to say any more. If you hear it, you'll get all of that and more.
Well, it's fun to go through the pieces in Children's Corner. Can you share why he wrote those pieces?
Well, I think he wrote them for his daughter, didn't he? They were sort of gifts for her. And I think that Debussy's a very grown-up composer in the sense his music is a lot of it quite X-rated. We just spoke about L'Île Joyeuse. It's a real X-rated piece. But I think with this, it was just a looking back, like many composers do. Schumann did the same and Tchaikovsky did the same. A looking back at childhood and at the innocence of childhood and finding in it something exquisite and something that maybe we all would love to regain as we get older.
Would you talk about those pieces, please?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that he gave it this English title, and the pieces have English titles. That's original. They're not translations. And they just cover many different styles. You have the first one, which is Dr. Gradus. Which is based on the idea of finger exercises that a young person might do, but he takes them and makes something absolutely beautiful and melodic and tender out of them. The second one is the lullaby for the elephant, Jumbo's lullaby. Has at the beginning a little gauche. He asks you to play it in that way, and there's a sort of wonderful humour about that. Then the Serenade for the Doll. Again, a very attractive, gentle little piece for the doll. Then you have The Snow is Dancing. Very similar to The Gardens in the Rain in the sense that it's someone looking outside the window into a garden, but on this occasion the rain has frozen and it's snow. Then you have The Little Shepherd, which has this little tootling of a pipe at the beginning. It's one of the most tender and touching pieces I think he wrote. Then the final one is the Gollywog's Cakewalk, which is a takeoff, of course, of Ragtime. Of early American music that had reached Paris at the beginning of the 20th century and was tremendously influential on so many French musicians. So those six pieces, a tremendous amount of variety within what's basically a rather short set.
The other two sets are the Image 1 and 2. What would you say is the difference between these two sets? Is there anything that you would like to cite that is, you know, sort of a growth in the composer, perhaps, or maybe a little bit different direction he was taking?
I think all six pieces in these two sets are absolutely top-draw Debussy. There isn't a bar in there that's wasted. It's all on the highest level of inspiration, and each piece is completely, utterly different from the other. This is, I think, what shows us the great composers, is they don't really repeat themselves. You know, they have fresh inspiration every piece that they write. You have the Reflet dans l'eau, Reflections in the Water, that begins Image 1. They're all great. This is maybe the greatest of the six. It's a piece of unbelievable beauty and invention. Again, sounds improvised but is tightly constructed. Then you have the homage to Rameau, the earlier generation French composer from the 17th century. I don't know quite why he called it that in some ways, because you don't really sense, at least I don't really sense, the shadow of Rameau's music in there. Even though it's written to be played in the tempo of a saraband. But I think it's just there's something very, very deeply felt about the piece, and it's a looking back perhaps on the whole culture of French music from its beginnings and sort of embracing that from the present. Thank you. Then you have the third movement called Mouvement, which is actually an interesting example of abstraction in Debussy, which he would come back to later in his life when he wrote his Etudes, which don't have poetic titles. They just have titles describing what you're meant to be studying in them. Mouvement is a kind of constant flow of triplets. Very difficult to play. Again, very inventive and a total contrast to the others. Cloche à travers les feuilles, Bells Through the Leaves, is the first book of set two. And here he has something that he does quite often, is a three-part form, and the parts are divided by tonality. So the two outer parts, the A sections, are whole note scales, which is a very characteristic sound of Debussy. He loved to use that colour. And then the middle section, we go back to the gamelan-type music with these wonderful bell sounds. The second piece, Et la lune descend sur le temple qui fut... You're really putting me through my French paces here.
Well, better you than me.
This is a wonderful poetic title. It's very hard to translate into English. And I was talking to someone in Paris about it, and he said, well, actually, it's very difficult in French, too, to understand exactly what it is. But the moon descends on the temple which was is literally what it is. Whether that's the ruined temple or whether the temple only existed in the mind or whatever it is, it's a wonderful, elusive image of the moon falling on some imaginary scene. It's a very still piece. There's a lot of silence in that piece, a lot of chords held long, so you hear the ringing decaying almost to nothing. And then the final piece, Poisson d'Or, which I'm told is not goldfish as in the bowl of goldfish, it was actually based on a Japanese print, is a piece full of humour. It's certainly fish-like, and you hear the fish leaping around and sliding through the fingers. In fact, your fingers have to slide on the keys quite literally. It's almost like you're describing with your fingers what's going on in the image. Piece full of whimsy and humour. So, yeah, six completely contrasting and wonderfully constructed pieces.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julia Mocker.